This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 10th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 305 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be meeting the French film director, François Ozon, the filmmaker whose deft satirical touch and willingness to challenge traditional ideas on gender come to the boil in his latest release, The New Girlfriend.
And we'll learn about the Arctic 30, the environmental campaigners who's challenged against an oil giant, saw them come up against a political one instead of Vladimir Putin. Ben Stewart will be here to tell their story.
And why did the chicken cross the world? It's a question we've asked ourselves on countless occasions, and now finally author Andrew Lawler is here to give us an answer. He'll be explaining the history of our feathered friends a little later.
That's to come. Plus, Tom Edwards will take back his rightful throne with the news look ahead, and we'll enjoy a good tune or two as well right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And there we have it. It's sort of like the old team, sort of the old personnel back. It's like the Expendables, Andrew.
You're back.
I don't know who I am. Which of you are in Expendables, the well-known movie franchise starring past action heroes, kind of getting blown up left, right and centre, starring the likes of Arnie, Sly Stallone and people like that. Who would be who?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm sure our listeners will write in.
That's not a question I can answer. Who would I be? I don't know. Or who would they be? That's very complicated.
It's a complicated question. I'd like to apologise also. Although this is a radio programme, I seem to have turned up in my gardening clothes.
Yeah, very cash day.
It's a bit.
You don't normally
bonfire.
Wear a polo shirt, but you look really nice.
It's all right.
It's fine.
I think it works without the jumper. With the jumper, it looks like I should be poking a bonfire, tapping one in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you were speaking at a nice conference the other day. Well,
yeah,
hosting.
Last week I wasn't here because I was down in Cheltenham for the Cheltenham Jazz Festival doing a couple of events with big Gregory Porter.
Wow, he loves us. And we had a great session with him.
Yeah, I think we've had a couple of sessions with Gregory. He's come in when the Culture Show was also the home of the Midori House Sessions. He came in a couple of times and he liked it so much, he asked us to go down and chat with him at Chelts.
Well, talking about big men and their sessions, should we call in Tom Edwards?
Who's got a waggy tail?
Who's got a winning grin?
Who can sniff out the spookiest news?
Who knows when to bark and bite?
Who's got the nicest coat?
Who can round up some global tales?
Who can scent a breaking story?
And who likes his tummy tickled?
Oh yes, it's that lovable news hound.
It's Tom Edwards.
Come home, Daddy.
Oh my God.
We enjoy that so much every time we hear it.
Well, I haven't heard that for a while.
That is so good.
That's brilliant.
It makes me realise I've not been in this chair, have I, for a few weeks? I think I've built my confidence back up.
It's the game of News Thrones, and you finally are the king once again, Tom. Welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be here on this side of the table, Rob and Andrew. It's that talking dog bit at the end.
I know, it's so weird. Come home, Gregory.
It's not right.
It's really weird.
It's not right in any respect.
I know.
Where are you going to begin?
Let's start in Cuba, shall we?
Yeah.
Cuban President Raul Castro is meeting Pope Francis. Well, I mean, technically, we're starting at the Vatican City because he's at the Pope's office today having a catch-up. Raul Castro's thanked the Pope for the role he played in the sort of Cuba-US rapprochement. Mm-hmm. And they're having a chat about the support that both sort of countries, states require. But I think it's interesting because tomorrow, the French president, François Hollande, is visiting Cuba. So presumably Raul must be jetting straight back over again. First ever visit by a French head of state. So it's the sort of, you know, the reintegration of Cuba with the sort of international community.
And they also announced this week they're going to have the first ferry services.
Ferry services to the US as well, yeah. I just think it's super interesting to watch how it shapes up. I mean, everyone's kind of excited initially. But what actually happens? What's the nuts and bolts of it? It's interesting.
And also fascinating that the Cubans are still rightfully foot on the brake. They don't want it to happen too quickly and they're cautious about how this unfolds.
Well, a lot of people have suggested that it's really important to go to Cuba now before inevitably, you know, the relationship with America, the different, you know, economic circumstances change things. A lot of people maybe fearfully say it might change indelibly. I don't know.
Well, all that lovely architecture that we like so much that is crumbling, and all the cars that we love so much because they're sort of falling to bits in a charming way, all that kind of noble rot that we see in Cuba is obviously kind of like the leftovers of the last time the Americans kind of commercially invaded, or the world commercially invaded that island. So it's kind of, it's one of those weird things when we like the hotels kind of falling down, but with the charm. I wonder what will happen with all these new ones. It's an interesting one. As for François Hollande going, there's a lot of French interest in Cuba. I remember when I went there, I realised that like Pernod Ricard own all the distilleries there, all the Cuban rum is French.
It's interesting because the money involved it's not huge. It's about 350 million euros a year in terms of Franco-Cuban trade, which is maybe not quite as much as you would imagine. Presumably that's what this is all about because the balance already is in the French favour. So obviously maybe Hollande sensed an opportunity.
That first ferry trip from Miami or whatever to Cuba, that's going to be something worth going on. I'm going to book my ticket.
I was going to say.
That's great. How interesting is that? That'd be
I think it'd be incredible. Yeah, absolutely incredible. Yeah.
Okay, well, that was you've got a hole in one with the first one.
Oh, okay.
Went straight down the middle.
Well, let's see how we crash and burn with the next one. My international sort of esoterica that I like, the annual Bun Festival in Chongqing, Hong Kong's largest fishing island, which commemorates the time.
I'm interested.
Well, it commemorates the. Andrew, behave yourself. It commemorates the time when the island was devastated by a storm and then hit by the plague. See, that's serious.
Okay. Why does it commemorate that? It's a bun, as in like a nice bun, like a Chelsea bun.
Well, no, so this is it. So they believe their island was haunted. So the islanders performed sacrifices to the gods, building these high bamboo towers studded with thousands of steaming buns erected in front of the Pak Tai Temple. And they were offered to the Chinese spirits to try and ward off the ill will. One detail that I feel I should share with you. During the main pageant, children are dressed as mythological heroes. And then at the end, a big effigy of the King of the Ghost is set alight and everyone tucks into the buns.
And after the buns, where next?
Turner Prize, Tuesday. The shortlist is out, Rob. I don't know what you're expecting to see.
We had less videos, hopefully.
Duncan Campbell, of course, won 2014's version. The winner will be announced towards the end of the year, but nominees are out. So that's, and I've got a bit more sort of culture-y action for you. Cannes Film Festival starts on Wednesday. Always a bit of a good one. I don't know, are you heading down?
I think our man Jason Solomons is going to be there for us.
Nice.
He'll be on the end of the telephone for you, possibly, Tom Edwards, and all the M24 people.
That's good. And we've got the Joel and Ethan Coen, Palme d'Or winners, formerly, are presidents of the jury, along with the host of, you know, big names and all this sort of thing. So
I think that'd be good. I think it's great when it's people like that.
Well, luckily, that's kind of set us up because in a moment we're going to be speaking to François Ozon, who's one of France's biggest film directors.
Absolutely. So it's a cinematic bonanza, I'm going to call it.
What's that in French?
Le bonanza cinématique.
Oh. C'est vrai. C'est vrai.
Vraiment. Do you want a couple more? I just thought reflect back. Andrew, was it
he's really missed doing it, hasn't he?
Was it you and I in the chairs last week? I can't remember. And Daniel Giacopelli was telling us what was
Daniel,
it.
Daniel, hold on. He wasn't quite telling. He had a list of things he could barely articulate.
But I want to develop one of those themes. So he mentioned last week, I'm pretty sure, the Sandwich of the Year Award.
Yes.
And we gave him the metaphorical slap around the face for bringing that up. However, on Thursday, we learn the winner.
The Sandwich of the Year.
Sandwich of the Year. Which
is this
prompts
like a
me
new
to
type
ask,
of sandwich, or is it the best prepared sandwich?
It can be a classic, it can be a new, it can be a new interpretation.
I don't like a wet sandwich. Like a Reuben. Everyone goes crazy for a Reuben. Yeah. I don't like a Reuben.
Oh, really?
No.
Like a toasted? Or must it be?
I'm happy to have a toasted.
I don't think, yeah.
If you were, okay, well, how about, what would the...
Rob's got so many weird food rules. He's going to have some kind of...
Oh, it's like no fruit in the afternoon or something?
Never have breakfast with someone unless you've slept with them. That's one of his first ones.
Fair enough, isn't it?
I don't know if that's a food rule so much as a lifestyle guide.
I got very fat for a while, though.
Be careful if he asks you around for some toast.
Okay. Noted. And just one final thing.
I won't offer to brush the crumbs off.
Well, no, oh, dear. Heavens above. One final thing. If you are feeling a bit portly from overindulging one way or the other, do you know what it is all week? You'll like this, Andrew. It's annual walk to work week next week.
Okay.
There's a challenge. Will you stroll in one day?
I can do that. But I don't have that
from
fast
home.
Calm.
I'm sure I can get into the living room.
don't count on it. But yeah, so people around the world, get your walking boots out.
That's a really good. That's genuinely when they have all these funny weeks like Easter Sausage Week and all the rest of it.
It's kind of not.
That's actually genuinely great. Exactly. Walk to work is a great, rare pleasure, isn't it? Andrew can do it. I'm a bit too far away.
Weather in London's been kind of half decent. Yeah. Enough, so.
Well, you don't want it too hot because aspiring when you get in.
That's right.
It's got so many weird weather rules, Andrew, isn't he?
It's not a rule off from you two.
Oh, let's have another one. You can't have orange juice after 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
It's just weird. It's not right.
What about in a... Oh, no, yeah, Bucks Fizz. That's a bit of a morning thing, isn't it?
You can't have a banana after six. Another one of his.
6 p.m. 18 p.m.
Yeah. Josh Fennett, our edits editor, who sits opposite me.
He's into fruit, isn't he?
Let's just leave it there, yeah. On that bombshell. Tom Edwards, thank you so much.
The French film director François Ozon is a celebrated auteur whose productions ooze satirical flair and flaunt a loose way with sexual politics on screen.
Films such as 2003's thriller Swimming Pool and 2002's darkly comic musical Huit Femmes have won plaudits from critics and fans alike. But today, Paris-born Ozon is here to talk about his latest work, an adaptation, in fact, of the recently passed away British crime writer Ruth Rendell, and it's called The New Girlfriend. François, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. It's great to have you here. We'll set up the film, I guess, first of all. It's an amazing idea. The New Girlfriend is about a guy whose wife dies, and he decides to take on the mantle of his wife in a strange way. He wears her clothes, and it transpires that he's always liked dressing as a woman. But that is the kickoff for a lot of fantastic, interesting, transgressive things that happen in this film. Maybe we should talk about Romain Duris, who's your star.
Duris,
who's the star of the show. The casting was so important for this. I know you've worked with him before. Was he always the person you had in your mind for this?
No, actually I had nobody in mind, except maybe Leonardo DiCaprio, but I knew he won't be able to make a French movie like that.
Yeah.
So I did a long cast, and I met all the French good actors. And for the test, I asked them to wear a wig, to have some makeup, and to see how they move as a drag. And many of them were very disturbed and annoyed to do that, except Romain, who was very excited. And I had read before an interview in which he said, one of my dreams is to play the part of a woman. So it was quite obvious to cast him because his desire, his joy, his pleasure to play a woman was so obvious, you know, to see. And it was quite shocking because he didn't want to take off his female clothes sometimes.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I mean, there is that thing. I wonder, from a director's point of view, whether you want to resist an actor's, you know, a lot of male actors' resistance. You want to resist their resistance, you know, when they don't want to dress up as a woman. And maybe that's part of the play of it.
You know, when an actor says no, he's always right. Sometimes for your ego, you know, you're upset. But I think if there is no desire, if there is not an envy from the actor, it's quite difficult to make a good film. So with Romain, he was very childish, he was very innocent with the part, and it was exactly what I was looking for, because I didn't want to make something perverse or grotesque, and I wanted to have this childish feeling.
The film, from how we're describing it, we should be careful to make sure to the audience, this isn't a film, as you say, about, you know, just the garish world of a guy trying to be a woman. What's interesting is his behaviour and what he does tests all the people around him as well, all the characters who come through the play. It asks them questions about their sexuality.
Gender.
Yeah, their gender, how they see each other. And most pertinently, you know, his wife's former best friend, who, there's a great moment in the film where they're away, and he says to her about dinner, "Who do you want me to come as?"
Yes.
and it really kind of, you realise that for her as well, there are real questions around this. Was it important to you that this was a film that did reflect on all of these elements without coming up with too obvious answers?
But you know, for me, the character of Romain Duris is not the lead character. For me, the lead character is the girl, is Anaïs de Moustier, the character of Claire. She's the one we follow, and it's her journey we follow during all the film, and you see all the story through her eyes. And she's the one who will really become a woman. It was quite obvious for me. I had to involve the audience with this character, to understand much better the character of David, who is quite a clear character. He wants to become Virginia. And I think it's more complex for Claire, who doesn't know who she wants to become, and she doesn't know exactly what are her feelings. Does she feel attraction or repulsion? And it's all these mixed feelings I wanted to show in the story.
We said in the introduction to your other films, François, we talked about Swimming Pool. We called it a thriller in the introduction. I wonder whether actually most of your films have always resisted the idea of a genre. This isn't, as Andrew said, this isn't a garish thing about a guy dressing up as a girl. And also it doesn't treat these gender politics in the sense, in the way that most films do. It's not like Some Like It Hot. It's not just a farce, you know. And I wondered about
that. Some Like It Hot is not a farce for me. It's a very political movie.
Okay.
But it's a very strong film, no?
No,
of the best films about cross-dressing.
It's clearly a great film. But do you know, yes. It seems that there are moments of this is a charming film, but it's not glib.
It's more than charming.
It's not glib. It doesn't expect the audience to think what it thinks all the time, I think.
You know? I think it does.
Okay.
I think. No? You should see it again.
Yeah.
I think it's a very...
Oh, was this one of your touchstones then for this film,
yes.
Was it?
Actually, I wrote the script of this film during a time in Paris, or in France, which was quite difficult because we had a lot of protest against the gay wedding and many people protest fighting against the new rights for minorities, you know, people who want to have different life, gay people or all these kind of people. And it was quite shocking to see that today in France, some people were against new rights. So I had that in mind writing the script, and I realized I didn't have to make a film against these people, but for these people. That's why I wanted to involve the audience in the story and try to show that it's not so dramatic to have a different life and a different kind of families and sexuality are possible today.
And touching on those protests, what was interesting also about those protests, it wasn't just about people's sexuality, but it was the right of, you know, who had the right to form a family.
Yes.
And again, there's a really, there are many amazing moments with that baby where you question yourself, you know, who makes a good mother and who makes a good father, especially when you're seeing it all in the one character. Was this also part of the debate that you wanted to be involved in, to throw back to the audience, you know, a reflection for them to think about?
Yes,
what,
of course.
Who is the mother?
Yes, absolutely. It was the idea of the film to show the complexity and to give the opportunity to the audience to ask themselves, what is the part of a father? What is the part of a mother? And all the cliché we have about femininity and masculinity. It was a good opportunity to ask all these questions in a very entertainment film.
And how has France responded?
The film was very successful. I think part of the success come from Romain Duris, who is very popular in France, and people were quite surprised to see their French sex symbol playing a woman. But I think we had a good response, and actually, I didn't have so many attacks from the white and maybe from some white newspaper. But it was not really about the film. It was more about they didn't like the story and they didn't like my way of directing. You know,
one thing I noticed is that there are lots of people looking in mirrors, performing the rituals that make them who they think they are. People putting on makeup, people shaving. There's a lot of mirror work. And I wonder whether that was something that was always written into the script, or whether that was something that you worked with the actors on to see how they felt doing these things.
It was important to be realistic. Yeah. And you know, the work for someone who makes cross-dressing is a lot about beauty, because, you know, to become a beautiful woman, it's a lot of work. And for Romain, he came every day 2 hours before us, and he became a real actress. You know, we had to wait for him on the set, so it was
method.
Yes.
And tell me, the journey of this film has been, it's been very successful at the film festivals. It's had very good reviews. But for the journey of a French film now outside of France, how successful can you be? What's your hopes and ambitions for this film as it goes around the world?
You know, I'm lucky because my films are not big productions. I'm not making a blockbuster, so I don't need to have huge success to make my next movie. This film was quite not a low budget, but a normal budget. So very often my films are sold everywhere, but that doesn't mean they are successful everywhere. It depends on the countries. For example, I was quite surprised the film is successful in Italy. And it's funny because many of the distributors say it's impossible to release such a film with Romain Duris as a woman. And actually, you know, they are not so machist, you realize. And in Germany, it didn't work at all. They didn't like, the audience didn't like, because the reviews were good. So each time in each country, you have different reactions. But I have the feeling the English understand much better than the French, the story. Maybe because there is a tradition of cross-dressing in England, I don't know.
Well, we've seen on the campaign trail up in Scotland, yes, with the Scottish Labour Party. We've seen a famous comedian here who's a transsexual out dressed as a woman campaigning on national television with no comment made about it. I think that's the important thing.
Yes, in fact, Eddie Izzard used to wear skirts in Scotland.
Yes,
it always works there.
I don't think I would dare tell a Scot though that was the reason.
Okay. Maybe it also met one of Britain's greatest living artists.
My first idea was to make the film in English first because it comes from Bruce Wendell. Yeah. And I had Ewan McGregor in mind to play the part of David.
Well, that's an interesting thing. And what about the Ruth Rendell thing? How closely did you stick to that original thing? I mean, I think it's a short story, isn't it?
It's 15 pages. Actually, yeah. I read the short story 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, I tried to adapt it as a short film. Very faithful adaptation, but I didn't find the actor, I didn't find the money, so I gave up. But I had still the story in mind. And 2 years ago, I read again the story and I realized the plot was still very good. But with time, I didn't want to make a murder story anymore. I wanted to make a love story. So I changed all the ending and the start of the story because there is no story of grieving in the short story of Ruth Rendell. So it's a kind of betrayal. But there is the spirit of Ruth Rendell. But I'm very sad she passed away because she was supposed to see the film these days. So it's quite sad.
If we could come back to the issue of the rights, we've seen in the US, the success of TV series like Transparent. There seems to be an interest in what it means and the politics and the sexual politics that go around with cross-dressing. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because it is the new frontier? It's like the next group of people who need to be given rights and be recognised and not mocked. Is this as rights spread? Why do you think we're more intrigued by this as a topic at the moment?
I think it's the evolution of the society and it's a kind of progress for all the minorities to exist and to pretend to have a real place to be recognized. I think it's the logic of the future, I think. And I think it's the next group which need help actually to be protected and to be respected and to be accepted.
Because in the film you say it's almost it's quite a funny moment. You realize it would be easier if he was gay, if he was just straight gay, and that everybody could cope with that. They've already kind of worked out their scenarios.
Yes, because gay people are accepted now. Yeah. But I think it's more shocking because when you are a cross-dresser, when you want to change your identity, you try to break the rules of gender, of identity, of what your family, what the society learned you to be. So you have to become someone new. So people are afraid of new things. So you are a creature and there are people who don't want to choose their sex. So it's the new challenge.
Well, it's a fantastic film. It's entertaining and it's effortless as well. Thank you so much, François Ozon, for coming
in.
And I'll go and do my homework on Some Like It Hot.
Okay.
And The New Girlfriend is in cinemas from May 22nd. Time for some new music now. Here's some relaxing Sunday sounds from Chicago's Riley Walker with On the Banks of the Old Kishwaukee. That was Chicago's Riley Walker with On the Banks of the Old Kishwaukee. We'll be talking to Ben Stewart about Arctic oil after this.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
In 2013, the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise staged a protest and oil rig in the Prizlomnye oil field, 60 miles off Russia's northern coast in the Arctic Circle. They were highlighting the threat that industrial drilling poses to the receding ice in the Arctic, but the story took an even higher profile turn when the activists were arrested and charged with hooliganism and piracy by Russian authorities, eventually being kept prisoner for over 100 days.
It was only a pardon from Russian President Vladimir Putin that concluded a tense standoff between Russia and much of the West, a precursor to the still straining diplomatic relations following the invasion of Ukraine. As head of media for Greenpeace, Ben Stewart was part of the campaign to free the Arctic 30, and he tells their story in his new book, Don't Trust, Don't Fear, Don't Beg, The Extraordinary Story of the Arctic 30. And he joins us now to talk about this amazing book. Ben, in the end, who wins?
It's a really good question. I had a chat with Martin Sixsmith, who used to be the BBC's Russia correspondent and went on to write the book Philomena that was turned into a movie, and he was advising us a little bit throughout this saga. And I met him in a cafe after my friends were released, and I asked him that question, who do you think has won? And he said, you both won. You got your guys out. You were terrified that you wouldn't. You were terrified that they would be in jail for 15 years and their families wouldn't see them, and some of them wouldn't have kids, and some of them might have died in there. But he said Putin won as well. And he said that from the point of view of Putin, this played really well in the sticks. He said Ivan and Masha, which I guess is the equivalent of John and Jane in the Anglosphere, Ivan and Masha would have loved this. They would have thought that he was standing up to foreigners who were interfering in Russian affairs. Look, I'm not that bothered about whether Putin won or lost. We just wanted to get our guys out. We were terrified that we had lost them to the Russian judicial system. We knew that they were in a brutal isolation prison in Murmansk in the Arctic Circle, a former mental asylum. We found a way to smuggle letters in and out to them, and the letters that we were getting from them indicated to us that they were suffering. So when they got out, I think we regarded it as a win. Whether Putin won or not, who knows?
Tell me, what's also interesting, I guess, you know, you were part, as we said, of the team that working for Greenpeace. But when you read the book, it's not just a hero story. You know, you reflect on these dark moments and tough times. Did you think it was important to take a step back from just being, you know, this being a Greenpeace kind of mouthpiece, just a PR story, that you wanted to reflect on the difficult times as well?
I really regretted that I was coming to this story with the title Greenpeace Head of Media, because people will assume that I would try to write a propagandistic piece where I tried to persuade people that Greenpeace are heroes and everything was fine. And what I instead tried to do, I used to be a journalist, was to approach this story rather like a journalist. What happened was that I was there when my friends got out of jail. I was having a beer with Frank Hewitson on his first night of liberty, and he told me the most extraordinary stories about life inside Russian jail. I had assumed that he'd lay there on a bed, staring at the ceiling, possibly reading the complete works of Shakespeare, occasionally playing a harmonica, and that nothing really happened, and he waited for us to get him out. Instead, he was involved in this remarkable prison ecosystem with mafia bosses, murderers, tension, fear, etc. And I wanted to bring that out. That was the story I heard from him, and I started speaking to the others. In answer to your question, you know, did I want to show the dark side? Yeah, I really did. I wanted to also explore some images about, or some issues about, Greenpeace's culpability here. Were we naive to send those guys up there? Should we have known that Putin would have arrested them and put them in jail for that length of time? Some people say yes, some people say no. I don't come to a conclusion, but I wanted to explore them. But really, the book started that night speaking to Frank and Anthony, who just got out of jail, and them telling me what it was like inside a Russian isolation prison held with murderers when you thought you wouldn't get out for 15 years.
Ben, you talked about, you know, the importance of wanting to get your guys out. That was one of the genesises of the book, and that was obviously your first thought on hearing the news. At what point were you managing both their release and the media campaign and realising that actually this stuff could be used for Greenpeace's favour?
It's funny, we...
You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Look, I sat down and wrote the strategy on, you know, the first day I was put on this, and I wrote, number one, the only thing that matters is getting them out. And then number two, in the process of getting them out, if we can also talk about the Arctic campaign and the reasons that they were there, then that's good as well. That's not just because I wanted to, like, persuade people that we need to save the Arctic. Those guys went there for a reason, and they would have felt it was a dereliction of duty if we hadn't used their imprisonment to try to explain to the world why they took on Arctic oil in the first place, why they were so concerned about the oil rigs moving north. And if we hadn't have done that, I think Frank and Phil and Anthony and Alex and all the others would have torn strips off us on that first night when they got out if they heard that we hadn't talked about the campaign and only talked about how they got out. But there was a tension because some of the family members came to us and said, what are you doing using this as a campaign initiative? You should just be getting them out. I hate the fact that you're talking about the Arctic. You should only be talking about human rights. You should sound more like Amnesty International at the moment. And hell, maybe they were right. You know, we had some really tense moments trying to get them out, and we didn't always agree. But in the end, it was a good news story. And I hope in the book I've kind of captured some of the tensions that we were going through. But this isn't so much a book about the campaign to get them out, although that's part of it. It's really about going inside prison and explaining what it feels like to lie there and feel that your life is over. And I spoke to about 15 of the 30, and some of them were so good at telling their stories that it really made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I hope when you read the book, it does the same for the reader.
Well, as you say, you know, Frank, you know, wakes up to find that he's been put in with two killers, I think.
Yeah.
And for them, that, you know, that darkness of being imprisoned, you know, being part of the Russian prison system, give some examples of the kind, what it was like for them being in jail.
Well, it was very scary. They were told that they were charged under Article 227 of the Russian Penal Code, minimum 10 years in a country where 99% of people who are charged end up being found guilty. So they were very, very scared. They were scared because of that minimum 10 years. They were held with people who faced similar sentences, and they were people accused of murder and manslaughter. So Frank was held with a guy called the Taser Kid, someone whose modus operandi was to attack people with tasers and then assault them and rob them and worse. And all of them were held with incredibly scary people. But what happened then was really interesting. These Russian prisoners took them under their wing. They looked after the Arctic 30. They felt that Putin had enacted a great injustice against them. The mafia bosses who controlled the place took them under their wing and looked after them. And they taught them how to communicate with each other. So they were held in cells with Russians, but the mafia bosses told them to use the Doroga. It's a Russian word, it means the road. And the Doroga is a system whereby you take the plastic bags that the gulag bread comes in and you spin it overnight into ropes. And then you hang these ropes up, down, left and right outside your window against the wall. And the people catch them and you create a big sort of network of ropes against the wall, like a physical prison internet. And using that, they were able to share notes and share cigarettes and contraband, and the mafia bosses dispensed justice and controlled the place through this network of ropes. But because the Arctic 30 were allowed to use the Doroga, they were allowed to stay in contact with each other, and some of them, when they got out, said the Doroga to them was life. Now, the women, and there are 8 women in the Arctic 30, were held in solitary confinement, and they weren't given access to the Doroga, but they developed their own ways to communicate. So they, on their 1 hour of exercise a day, shouted over a wall at each other. They couldn't see each other. And they devised a code whereby they would tap on a radiator pipe and manage to pass messages to each other. One tap was A, 2B, 3C, etc., right up to 26 taps for Z. And they showed me their notebooks when they got out, and there were page after page of writing, you know, sentences about as long as a tweet. And it would take a day to have this conversation. You know, it would take 10 minutes just to say, how are you this morning? Yes, I'm fine. My lawyer's come in. Do you think we'll ever get out of here? But they, through that communication, managed to stay alive as well. And what they said to me was that human interaction was the single most important thing. And that held for the men as well, who found human interaction with murderers and people accused of manslaughter was vital to them. And they found the humanity and the goodness in these people.
Now, they were released, and many in the West felt that there was an event that came to the rescue, that it was the fact that the Sochi Olympic Games were coming up, and it would have looked not very good PR for him to have them in jail. Do you think that was one of the key reasons they got out?
Yeah, I think that if it wasn't for Sochi, we might still be running a campaign to get the Arctic 30 out. It's possible. I don't know. You know, it's counterfactual, isn't it? The fact is that Pussy Riot, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the main anti-Putin dissident in Russia, and the Arctic 30 were all released in the same week, 6 weeks, I think it was 6 weeks before Sochi. And it seems clear that there was a link between those things. Quite frankly, Putin didn't want protests at Sochi. He might have got them over Pussy Riot, probably not so much over Khodorkovsky, but the Arctic 30 movement was huge at that point. We had millions of people signed up, thousands marching in the streets. And I think he feared what it would have done to Sochi. Our intelligence, and we had people from inside the Kremlin talking to us, said that Putin was furious with us and he wanted to show us a lesson, teach us a lesson, and it could be years before we got them out. Something changed in the run-up to Sochi, and thank God it did.
In the film of Don't Trust, Don't Fear, Don't Beg, would you play yourself?
How do you know there's going to be a film of Don't Trust, Don't Fear?
Just sounds too good. It sounds too good for there not to be.
There might be news about that at some point, but not yet.
It's made for
it's absolutely it starts
the,
on
the ship in the Arctic
high seas, Russian prisons, and people that are larger than life in every possible respect.
I hope there will be a film. Who would play me? I don't think I'm really that interesting compared to the people that had to communicate using this Russian prison system, and there was this amazing governor called Popov that psychologically tortured them and said that the Gestapo was his inspiration. They stand, he said, at the apex of penitentiary science. And I think it's far more interesting. It is a hell of a phrase, and I think it's far more interesting to consider who would play Popov than a mere press officer in London.
And tell me, at the end of the book, you say that there was some change that came about out of this protest. It did seem to move the discussion with governments around Europe. But when you speak to the Arctic 30 now, what is their feeling about those 100 days? How many of them say, do you know what, I would do it again? Of course, they have their bravery intact. And how many have said, do you know what, this isn't for me, I will not do this again?
Yeah, I mean, they're a mixed bag. They're not a kind of homogenous group, a herd. Some of them say, I'd do it again, even if it was years inside. It's too important. Some of them would say, I'd do it again, as long as I knew at the start that it was 100 days. And some of them would say, I wouldn't do it again, and I never, ever want to see that place again, Russian isolation prison. And, some of them are very comfortable with the fact that they went up there. Some of them feel that they should have known, and Greenpeace should have known, that this would happen. So, it's a mixed bag. Some of them, there's very, very tight friendship groups that are formed there because of this shared experience that they have. But no one member of the Arctic 30 says the same thing or had the same experience there.
Well, congratulations on a fantastic book. Thanks. Don't Trust, Don't Fear, Don't Beg, by Ben Stewart. Thank you very much for coming in.
Cheers. Thanks a lot.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
A messenger of the gods, a powerful sex symbol, the epitome of all evil. We are, of course, referring to the humbled chicken. Historically, the omnipresent chicken has had a far more complex journey than the one we all know about. For many of us, that's simply from farmyard to plate.
The bird's ancestor is the T-Rex, and over 10,000 years of domestication, it's assumed the role of being anything from an icon of devotion for Chinese philosophers to the butt of the world's most common joke. American science journalist Andrew Lawler felt there was more to the story and chose to tell it in his new book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? And he's crossed a fair part of the world himself today to join us here in the studio. Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. A great setup for your book. You explain
that you were trying to sell a very different book, and somebody spotted a mention of a very early discovery of a chicken, which turned out to be not quite true. But what was the spark around the chicken that encouraged you to think there was so much of a story to tell?
Well, I was dragged into writing about the chicken kicking and screaming by an editor at Smithsonian Magazine. But once I jumped into it, and after my protestations of I really don't do livestock were heard, I jumped in and I realized that the chicken is actually a wonderful way to tell the story of humans, to tell the story of how humans spread around the world, to tell the story of how we worship, of course, how we eat, how we entertain ourselves. Really, the chicken provides us with a mirror to humanity.
I mean, as the chicken, it was sort of domesticated, as we read in your book, it was domesticated for cockfighting rather than for food in the first instance, or at least in the West, am I right? Where does it come from?
Well, most people would be able to say, the dog came from the wolf. Yeah. But probably very few people, and including myself, when I first began this project, wouldn't have been able to say, where does the chicken come from? What is the wild chicken? It sounds rather oxymoronic, doesn't it? But there is a wild chicken. It's called the red jungle fowl, and it lives in South Asia, all the way from Pakistan to Indonesia. And it's a bird that is very secretive, very shy. It's a kind of pheasant. It lives in the jungles and doesn't like to get near people. It's been quite a mystery as to how this bird became what I would argue is the most important animal for humans today.
Now, you say there's, I think, 20 billion chickens on the planet, roughly three per head of the world's population. Does that point out why they're such a great source of, you know, food for us? You know, they seem to be quite easy to rear. You know, they're cheap protein. How vital is the chicken to us today?
There is no other single source of protein greater than the chicken. If you include the meat and the eggs, chicken is the way most humans get the most protein. So that gives you a sense of how important the chicken is. It may be small, but there are many of them. You add together all the dogs and cats and pigs and cows, and there's still more chickens. This is a new development. I mean, our great-great-grandparents thought very differently about chicken. Chickens were something that, yeah, you had for eggs, but it wasn't something that you commonly ate. It was something you would have maybe for a special Sunday dinner, but chicken was not, it tended to be kind of scrawny, and it was simply not part of the food chain in the way it is today.
This is presumably due to industrial farming methods. This is kind of where the sort of ubiquity of the chicken as foodstuff comes from. I know you've devoted chapters in your book to that, not necessarily to the mass farming and all the hard luck stories and the bad news stories that go with that, but actually the beginning of that was quite an interesting, the beginning of that industry came from interesting roots, didn't it?
Well, actually, there's a single person most responsible for today's industrial chicken. It is, of course, Queen Victoria. I was surprised to find this, but in fact, it's true. In the 1840s, a British sea captain who was coming back from the Opium Wars in China brought back several exotic Chinese chickens for Queen Victoria, gave them as a gift. She was enthralled. She built a beautiful new coop at Windsor, and suddenly it became all the rage to collect exotic chickens. You have to remember that British chickens at the time were rather scrawny and ornery and not much to write home about. But these new chickens from China were fantastic. They were huge. They were beautiful. They were regal. They had the regal quality, which I think probably drew Victoria's interest. So that was the beginning of what was called the fancy here in Britain. It spread around the world, and people became fixated and fascinated with these exotic chickens. And once the fad ended and it kind of crashed and people were left with some very expensive chickens in their coops, they decided, well, why don't we try and breed them? And sure enough, that led to the breeds which produce the meat and eggs of today.
Now, the book also charts that the chickens strut through the world of faith and religion. It's been revered at many points in its history. Could you tell us a little bit about its journey that's not on the plate?
Well, this was actually the very beginning of the chicken, that the bird, as you mentioned earlier, was actually not domesticated for its meat or its eggs. That came later. Anthropologists and archaeologists today believe that the bird actually was domesticated for religious purposes, in other words, to sacrifice. And that sacrifice often took the form of cockfights, that these were ritual events that would bring villagers together. And much as bullfighting began as a religious practice in the Mediterranean, so cockfighting began as a religious practice in Southeast Asia, which was the home of the wild chicken, the red jungle fowl. So it's probably through that that people began to transport the chicken around, to move it around, so traders would take their prize cock with them when they were going to the next village or the next town, and they would trade it. And then eventually the bird began to spread through South Asia, but it was primarily as a means for not just for religious purposes, but also to gamble.
And there's a bit in the thing where you, in your book, where you talk about a Roman Jewish philosopher who was quoting the ancient rabbis, wondering if a chicken was kosher or not, and certain parts of the world thought it was, certain parts of the Holy Land thought it wasn't, etc., etc. So it's something that sort of is divided people. And you said we set this thing up at the beginning by you saying it tells the story of humanity rather beautifully and rather exactly, right down to the differences in religions as well.
Absolutely. Although it's interesting that the chicken is rarely taboo in most cultures, unlike, say, the pig or the cow. Most cultures say it's just fine to eat chicken. You know, Hindus and Zoroastrians and a few others do not. But for the most part, the chicken has been seen as an animal that could be used not just for religious purposes, but also for gambling, of course, the eggs and the meat. So it was really an all-purpose creature. And also, I should mention healing. It wasn't just about chicken soup. That in the ancient world, so many of the prescriptions for what ailed you involved a part of a chicken. So the bird was this kind of Swiss utility knife that you could use it for almost any purpose under the sun. And so it was greeted with great fanfare when it arrived in places like Egypt or the Middle East or Europe, and then later the United States.
And what are the contemporary challenges? I guess, you know, we know of avian flu. We know that because there are so many birds, it's easy for disease to spread, and from birds to humans even. And we see these terrible incidents where birds are killed in the thousands and burnt for fear of spread to humans. But is the industrial production of the chicken, does it present us with other challenges as well?
Absolutely. You know, of course, most of your listeners will be aware of the situation with industrial farming. It's very controversial. The chickens are put in huge warehouses, those that are broilers, that is for meat, and then those that are layers. And there's a lot of controversy about the way these chickens are treated, about what they're fed, and about the safety of the chicken that is so vital to the human food supply. So certainly avian flu is a huge issue in the United States right now. Millions of birds are being culled in Iowa and other places. And the concern is that in these industrial operations, one sick bird, that virus could spread very quickly and then millions more could die. So there are two issues here. One is, can we protect this important part of the food supply? And then, of course, there's the question of whether these viruses and bacteria can leap to humans, whether or not people can become sick from these animals. And that's a second concern, but no less daunting, I think, when it comes to how we handle the chicken.
Who are the chicken heroes? Because I wonder whether we need chicken heroes, like we need Chaucer's Chanticleer or something to improve the brand of the chicken and maybe the lot of the chicken, therefore. Because if there were cozy chickens that we wanted to hang out with, or that were well-known cartoon characters or something, maybe we'd find it less easy to burn them in their thousands, as Andrew was saying. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know how many chicken heroes have been in literature, but maybe not enough.
Well, Chicken Little, I guess, probably wouldn't fall into that category. But the Chanticleer is one. I mean, obviously,
because there's a funny idea that, you know, KFC, you know, the ubiquitous of all of these chicken outfitters, they don't have a chicken on their branding. They have a Colonel Sanders character, or they have a different character. There's something maybe about the idea of looking at what you're going to eat that puts you off it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, most of the chicken jokes, or the idea that people are bird brains, or all kinds of epithets involving chickens, these are new. These only came about in the 1920s and 1930s when we began to industrialize chicken farming. Suddenly, chickens were concentrated in large numbers and away from people. So people didn't have immediate contact as they had in the past with chickens. So suddenly they were considered stupid. They have to be stupid, right, to end up in a farm like that without much independence. And, you know, the fact is that neuroscientists today have done lots of experiments to show that chickens actually have a pretty large intelligence, much greater than people would have suspected in the past.
And an ability to survive as well. That's the other thing that comes through in your book. You know, I know you say that they even did research to see if you could send chickens to space. The notion that here's a bird that can live in literally every single country in the world. It has it seems to be adapting to climate, to all sorts of terrain. What is it about the chicken, its DNA, its biology, that makes it so kind of fit for every environment, it seems?
Well, this is clearly why the chicken is the chicken today, why it's so important. And we don't really know. The chicken has, the genome was decoded about a decade or so ago, but it's still not clear why the chicken is so adaptable. But what we do know is that the red jungle fowl can live in a wide variety of environments, from the Himalayas to the jungles of Indonesia. So it's clear that this bird already had the wherewithal to survive in lots of different environments. And it seems so perfectly matched to human needs that, yes, if we go to Mars, there's no question the chicken will come along, because they've actually done experiments to show that chickens can survive the cosmic rays that they're likely to encounter. They can still lay eggs. They're not as affected by cosmic rays as perhaps some other animals. So the chicken is clearly adaptable. The Polynesians never would have settled the entire Pacific Ocean had it not been for the chicken, which provided all of these advantages in terms of protein and as well as entertainment that made it really a critical part of the settlement of one-third of the Earth 500 or 600 years ago.
It was fascinating stuff. The book is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? It's a great title. Andrew Lawler, thank you very much. I loved all our guests today. The show was a tightly packed, it was like a beautiful old-fashioned milk tray. It was great.
Yes, and one of those kind of delicious things was the story that Ben Stewart told us about the Greenpeace Arctic 30. Just a really great, great yarn. And I also really enjoyed meeting François Ozon, who super cool. And, you know, and he was enjoyably spiky in a nice kind of French way.
He was. He's one of my favourite film directors. It's always nice to meet people that you know better than you, certainly about the French language.
He's just good. He's just like, yeah. And it was interesting to, you know, he wanted to kind of set out, you know, Some Like It Hot is actually quite a political film.
Yeah.
And then we had chicken drumsticks as well.
Andrew Lawler was good, wasn't he?
Yeah. But
he's an amazing character.
And because, you know, he comes from a science background, and because he's a good, you know, just a good journalist, it's a really great book. It really, you know, you will want to know everything about the chicken.
I should also point our listeners in the direction of a magazine that he used to edit called Space Station Monthly, which we saw in his biography.
Yeah, he's got a super, super cool CV.
Yeah, it's a very amazing one. Well, that is it for edition 305 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager and researcher was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.